Today on Vox Talks Economics, is the US in a fiscal mess? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week, we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe. Follow us on Instagram as well. A new piece of research shows that the US federal debt is expected to grow to historic highs in the next 10 years. And, of course, the interest bill for that debt is going to continue to grow as well. So what are the consequences of this explosion of debt? And can policy, what policies can stabilize the debt to GDP ratio? And how much should policymakers worry about doing that? Giancarlo Cossetti of the European University Institute and Riccardo Trezzi of Underlying Inflation and the University of Geneva are two of the authors. They both join me now. Giancarlo, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Riccardo, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Now, Riccardo, how big is this deficit that the US is running at the moment?
Well, the deficit is pretty large because in 2024, the CBO is projecting the deficit at about 7% of GDP with a primary deficit of about 4% of GDP. Just to give you an idea, the historical average of the total deficit is about 4 percentage points of GDP and the primary deficit of about 1.5% of GDP. So the current deficit is, roughly speaking, 4 percentage points higher than the average of the previous 50 years. And it's even higher when it is compared to periods in which the US economy is close to full employment. In fact, what's really surprising is the fact that given the state of the labor market and the sharp expansion of the US economy that we got since 2022, the deficit is still very large. And in fact, the 7% deficit, total deficit in 2024 is the largest deficit ever recorded outside recessions and wars.
Gosh, why is it so high at the moment? It can't still be a COVID thing.
Yes and no, I would say. There is a little bit of everything when you look at the numbers. On the revenues front, taxes in the US are historically low, and so they are currently about 1 percentage point in revenues less than their historical average. However, the big problem are, in fact, the outlays and specifically the mandatory part. Starting way before COVID, so in the mid-2000s, the mandatory part, so we're talking about Social Security and the major healthcare programs, they're trending higher. And they're trending higher because essentially of aging and all of those issues that have never been really assessed by the Congress. In 2024, the spending should be about 3 percentage points higher than the average of the previous 50 years. The final issue is the fact that net interest payments, they've been growing because COVID was a very big shock. And we're living now in a world in which interest rates, nominal and real interest rates, are in fact higher than pre-COVID. Therefore, the interest bill, because interest rates are higher and because the debt is larger, is growing and is growing pretty fast. So the net interest payments in 2024 is already about 3%. So it's 1% higher than the average of the previous 50 years. Mm-hmm. And it is projected to almost double going forward. And therefore, where is it coming from? Well, it's coming from a little bit of everything. So lower taxes than we used to have, higher expenditures, and also higher interest bills.
But this isn't a secret, is it? What does the Congressional Budget Office say that the debt outlook is going to be?
The official documents are just singing the same song that Riccardo has been sort of singing for us. The fact that there are many reasons for which there is a very clear trend, a regime that is building up fiscal costs for the U.S. Riccardo did not mention it, but at this stage, the interest bill is above the military spending, which is quite the news for the U.S. It's not only the Congressional Budget Office, also the many part of the U.S. governments already last year have been pointing out this sustained trend. We are talking about, if I remember well, above 120% of GDP in 2034, with a bill that is increasing if nothing is done from here to there. Clearly something will happen, must happen. What is strange now is that given the plans today, there is no end to it.
But we have been here before on the debt ratio, and people who aren't worried about this point out that the dollar's still the global reserve currency, so that's something. Why do we worry more about it? Why are you worrying about it this time?
Well, let me put it this way. We may not be worried now. The question is when we'll become worried, in the sense that there could be a set of circumstances, geopolitical or other type, that raises the demand for the dollar in the world, maybe. There will be more space for absorbing more dollar. The question is, will the world be willing to absorb an ever-increasing mass of dollar? Mm-hmm. And this is what our little document, but also the Congressional Budget Office, the financial service of the U.S. government, have been sort of talking about, raising the question, what would be a reasonable scenarios for stopping the trend.
Galena Hale spoke to us in May 2023 about a different financial impact of the extraordinary events of 2020. Listen to our episode called How Much Inflation Did COVID Fiscal Support Cause?
You've looked at some of these scenarios for stopping the trend and what the implications of them are. For the projections you've come up with, what model are you using?
For the simulations, so we've been using the so-called FRB US model, which stands for Federal Reserve Board US model, which is a large-scale general equilibrium model, which is used by the Fed board staff to come up with simulations and scenarios for the US economy. Now, the model is very complicated. We have to mention that we were not alone in this journey, because Guido Ascario has also joined the team, and Tilda Orvard, so a former economist from the Fed board who has been coding and using the model for almost 20 years, is also an author of these simulations. But this is the main model that, again, the Fed staff uses for simulations, and it is publicly available.
If I may add, Tim, no matter what models you use, you may have a little bit of disagreement on details, but the picture that comes out is always the same. This is an important point. We are trying to be very rich, using a rich model, making sure that we look at every single corner of the facts of different scenarios, possible policies. But the trend is steady and really there. You will get it also with other models.
Now, let's play policymaker. So the obvious first policy reaction would be to cut government spending to stabilize debt. And you have analyzed a cut of 1% of GDP in government spending. Now, most government spending, if I remember correctly, is mandatory. So what sort of cuts does this actually mean in real life?
So the model is very rich. So in reality, we could simulate any cut to any part of G of government spending. As you mentioned, the discretionary part is pretty small, okay, and it's split essentially in between wages and federal purchases. And so we cut federal purchases because the assumption is the fact that, I mean, you don't really cut the wage portion.
No.
And the unpleasant part, of course, is the fact that if you really want to achieve 1% of spending cut in that way, then you have to cut almost 20% of that, which I'm not sure that it is feasible in the first place, but most importantly, even if you were able to do so, then the impact on the deficit, especially on the debt dynamics, would be pretty small, almost negligible. And the reason is because, as I was mentioning before, we are having a deficit which is 4 percentage points higher than the average, the historical average. Mm-hmm. And no matter what approach you try to use, whether you do it with a general equilibrium model as we did, whether you look at CBOs, whether you do it via a back-of-the-envelope calculations like Blanchard did essentially for France, or whether you look at, for instance, some of the simulations that the Bureau of Fiscal Service, U.S. Treasury, has put out, you always come to the conclusion, just to give the overall picture, that the adjustment of the primary balance that you need to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio is way higher than 1% of GDP. It is, in fact, around 4 percentage points of GDP. 4, not 1. Okay? Right. It depends a little bit on the scenarios, but yeah. It is 4%. And that's why if you cut G by 1%, you do achieve something, but the dynamics overall, they remain pretty unfavorable going forward.
Okay, my career as a policymaker has not got off to a good start then. So I'm going to have to reach for something else in my policy toolkit, raising tax instead. So if we're looking at tax increases, what sort of tax increases do we need to stabilize the deficit here?
Even, let's say, a relatively modest objective targeting the deficit, not the debt trend, just the deficit over the next few years, mm-hmm. you need to bring the average taxation on the personal income up 4 percentage points. So from the current 14% to 18%, which corresponds to an adjustment of 3%, so which is less than what Ricardo was saying you need basically to stop the trend. So it would be painful, it would be strong. The model captured the impact on the economy, but it would be insufficient. So there is this sense in which we believe that we will not see any slowdown of the accumulation of the debt, especially because of this strong component of interest payment in the next few years. We could even combine cut spending with taxation, but it's still painful.
Just a reminder, because I think this is maybe a point that is not sufficiently clear. In 2026 and 2027, some provisions of the 2017 tax cut will expire. So taxes are already set to go up in the US. Ah. I'm not sure how many people they know this, but now this is accounted in the CBO baseline, but is not accounted in our simulations because there is a question mark about the political feasibility of this going forward.
Well, certainly no one's mentioning it right at the moment.
Yeah, we don't want to enter, I guess, in the political space, but certainly we're not hearing anyone saying this during the current campaign. But technically speaking, if nothing happens, then taxes are already set to go up in the States in 2026 and 2027. But yeah, not enough in the sense that it wouldn't be enough to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio, not even in that case.
But maybe these borrowing costs that you have been warning about, maybe they will be lower. They would decline faster than, well, your model predicts. How big an effect could this possibly have?
This is definitely possible because in the model, the term structure is endogenous. So the model has a forecast, endogenous forecast for the 10-year, the 5-year, and the federal funds rates, and so on and so forth. And the model, at the time in which we were running it, was projecting the 10-year to be about 0.5 percentage points higher than in the CBO's projection. Now, that has an effect, of course. But again, even if you lower it by 50 basis points, you can even lower it by 80 basis points or so. But that's not enough to solve the issue here because, again, we start from 7% deficit and with about 4 percentage points of primary fiscal deficit adjustment needed. And so even if the borrowing costs, they are 50 basis points lower, at the margins, they do something, of course. But again, this is not enough to stabilize the debt to GDP dynamics. We need more than that.
Okay, guys, I've got a solution. We're going to grow our way out of this problem. How much additional growth is the US going to need to stabilize the debt ratio?
Let's have a very rosy picture of a sustained 2.5% mm-hmm. growth, which, you know, roots in the record of the US, but is definitely on the upper side.
Yeah.
The bad news is that that will not be enough. Actually, if, again, going with a simple back on the envelope calculation supported by our simulation, nothing short of 4% would be anything close to a solution. 4% may be in the desiderata of many people, but clearly you cannot count on it for a solution. So growth will definitely help. But again, like borrowing costs, it will help, but it's not the solution per se. There is an expectation that it will be a regime change at some point.
There's not a lot here in individual policy levers that's going to fix things. Let's say we wanted to make a short-term stabilization. What sort of mix of policies could we put together that would deliver that?
Well, there is certainly a mix of things that we can think and we can fit the model. As we say, we can torture the model until it gives us the answer that we want.
Yeah.
But the truth is that the answer is pretty either politically unfeasible or really unpleasant, certainly not optimal. If you really want to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio and make it sustainable, where sustainable means the debt to GDP ratio becomes flattish over time, at least, then you really need to implement everything, meaning that you need to cut GE probably by in between 1 and 2 percentage points, and you need to increase taxes pretty significantly. But then it goes down to what is the impact on the economy? Is it optimal? Or do you really want to do it? And the answer that the model gives you is that be very careful, because if you do it, then the model essentially tells you that growth becomes zero-ish for almost 2 years, and the unemployment rate goes up way above its natural rate, and above 5%, in fact, in the model. And so is this really a good outcome of this fiscal consolidation? Probably not. And so I guess that the takeaway that the model suggests is that in order to fix it, probably speaking, we need a little bit more time and we need a longer horizon. Trying to fix this in the next 2 to 3 years is either, again, politically unfeasible or definitely not even optimal from an economic point of view.
Not optimal is an understatement in the policy
not desirable
mind at the moment.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
It clearly cannot happen in the next 2 or 3 years.
Correct.
But let's take that longer view and say we want to fix it over, I don't know, a decade. Then what sort of policy does this imply?
Well, the surprise answer from the model is that it can be done smoothly over time at a reasonable cost, but still it requires decisive action. I mean, like, a long horizon is not a recipe for procrastination. It's actually a recipe for the miracle of bipartisan consensus sticking to a path, which requires some unpleasant, clearly politically unpalatable action from now. So we made some estimates in the near horizon adjustment. There is a few percentage point of increasing either tax revenue, reduction in spending. And again, a combination of all these would be ideal, smoothed over time, but not insignificant, not insignificant. If you try to delay the action, the cost skyrocket.
Yeah.
No, we had this document by the financial service that sort of look at the required adjustment. Today is about 4% of GDP, 4.5, but 10 years from now would be 5.3 and 20 years would be 6.5, which is absurd. So all this is to say that, again, we are not coming in from the perspective of lover of austerity. It's actually the opposite. What worries us is the fact that you want to have sustainable government spending on healthcare, education, infrastructure. You need to make it sustainable. And sustainable means not today, against tomorrow. It's not over time. You need to make sure that you have the resources to address the demand for services and possible redistribution issues, and make sure that, you know, you have a fiscal outlook that allows you to react to possible recessions. We haven't talked about the scenario recession, but that is also worrisome, because actually it would be the counterparty of the high growth. It would be a low growth would actually make things worse. So from a perspective of the desire of having a well-functioning government, this trend is not a good idea. This trend is not a good idea. And again, it could be that there will be more space for government treasuries in the US. So it's not about Armageddon today. It's just the fact that the trend cannot be considered a normal state of affairs, because sooner or later we'll create jitters, problems, not only political, can also have a backlash, political backlash that would be then against everything we say so far about the sustainability of a good government presence in the economy.
So we're at a moment in the US political cycle where these things aren't being discussed, and we're in an environment where these things are rarely discussed calmly and in a bipartisan way. First of all, how much of that spending is going to go on debt in the near future if we don't stabilize the ratio? And secondly, we may well be looking at a recession in the next presidential term. What would happen?
I'll start from the second one. During recessions, yields, they generally go down, and significantly so. So the US is issuing right now at about 4%. on the 10-year. So in the case of a recession, the 10-year yield would drop significantly. But the problem is that recessions are also the moments in which the deficits, they grow much larger.
Yeah.
And so if you start with a deficit of 7%, now depending on the type of recessions, of course, but even with a mild recession, you might actually end up with in double digits with the deficit. And so it doesn't really matter in a sense if you issue at 2.5% or 3% on the 10-year, if you have to finance 10% or 11% or even higher of GDP per year. Unfortunately, recessions, they make everything worse, including the dynamics of the deficit and the debt. So we cannot count on that as a margin of adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, this means that, sure, we will go through up and downs in the next 10 years or 20 years or so. But again, we can't really just delay everything because we fear that there will be a recession. If there will be a recession, then of course, we will evaluate what to do in that case.
And the payments to service the debt.
So the cost in the baseline this year is expected to be already about 3% of GDP. I'm talking about the net interest payments here. And this is already above the entire military spending in 2024. And if we don't fix anything, in the CBO's projections, it goes up to well above 4%. And in our projection, in fact, it goes above 5% or 6%, depending on the scenarios. And so in general, I think that the argument of saying Japan, for instance, is a country in which the debt to GDP has been rising for 30 years or so, and nothing really has happened. But the main difference is that Japan has been issuing at ultra low nominal interest rates. So the cost of servicing the debt has remained very, very, very low. And in the US, however, we are not there in the sense that it is a growing economy that has different fundamentals and different potentials. And so going forward, the suspect is the fact that, again, the net interest payments will rise from here. And it's very important to understand that it does have consequences even from a redistributional point of view because it's very distortive. And so there is a trade-off, of course. If we really want to make sustainable spending in education and healthcare and everything else, we can't simply let the net interest payments to grow and double or more than double going forward, because that would, of course, subtract resources for other type of spending.
Your statistic about the comparison of interest payments against military spending is mind-blowing. In the US, there is a regular piece of political theater, which is the argument over its debt ceiling, because that becomes legislative. And bearing in mind that in this conversation, which involves some unpleasant numbers, but we're talking seriously about this, there really is no politically feasible prospect of stabilizing debt in the near future. Is it time that the US stopped having this political argument? Because that seems to me to get in the way of any bipartisan effort to address the problem.
This should be asked not to us, but to the US parties. Yes. The debt ceiling, if you look in the past, has certainly not played a very positive role. It is one of the moments in which at least there is an awareness of this issue. It is true that, you know, in a very distorted way, and oftentimes it's just played politically for this or that. Again, my impression is that the solution will require some kind of bipartisan reason, no? Like the return of rhyme and reason, which is maybe difficult, but it is what could create a way out. Consider that there are many stone guests that many readers of the Vox EU raise with us, for example, a large increase in tariff revenue. We look into that. Tariff revenue is already large. The additional tariff revenue that could be gained is not dramatically different. There is the possibility of a vast drop in borrowing cost. But again, looking at the numbers, and we go a long way to reduce, no? And the last bit is, of course, the possibility of some kind of contribution of inflation. This is something that we are thinking about, and we may actually ask you to have us guest again, to have a reasonable assessment of this point. As of today, none of these elements would offer a complete solution to what we try to achieve in this piece, which is simple, in a way, simple awareness of where the US is going at this point.
And some of your colleagues who have analyzed this have come up with a slightly different conclusion, which is that these numbers are indeed unpleasant, but that perhaps we shouldn't be worrying about them too much right now because there are urgent needs on healthcare, education, infrastructure spending, and that it would be wrong not to make those spending commitments today because people need them today. How much credibility does that argument have?
You need to have systems of healthcare, of education, infrastructure, rebuilding that are sustainable. There is an element of investment in some of these areas which would justify an upfront spending. It would be good to stop everything tomorrow. The scenario that we build, a crash scenario, is something that, apart from the political unattractiveness, is clearly not desirable from any economic point of view. But those are not one-time-off spending items. Those are regimes that last a long time. So it is important to make them consistent with a reasonable budget process. Also to avoid bad surprises and create, by the way, extreme inequality across generation, you know, like people retiring with vastly different retirement income because all of a sudden we discover that the Social Security is not sustainable anymore. So it is something that requires a view that is not about today and tomorrow. It's a little bit more long-lasting.
I can make an analogy on this point, which is to say that the current deficit and debt situation of the US is a little bit like having a crack on the roof of the house. We are living in a sunny day today. Tomorrow, you don't know. Maybe there will be a storm. You do not want to find yourself in a place where you find out that the crack was in fact larger than you realized when it is storming. You want to do something now, maybe, to fix it and to forget about it. We are just the guys who point the finger to the crack and say, I think there is a crack here.
It would be interesting to know what is the current thinking also among the US legislators and policymakers about this, whether they're aware, whether they understand that at some point there will be a moment of truth in their policymaking.
Ricardo and Giancarlo, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
If you want to see just how big that crack in the roof of the house is, read the article. It's called The US Fiscal Mess, Some Unpleasant Fiscal Simulations. And the authors are Guido Ascari, Giancarlo Cossetti, Tilda Horvath, and Riccardo Terezzi. It was published on Vox EU on the 26th of July, 2024.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. If you're enjoying these episodes, remember to follow us wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And tell your friends about us. Next week on Vox Talks, protest movements, how they are born and how they die.